always had to bring a branch of a tree back with you to prove that you'd been across. And then we'd walk back home again, and many a night my dad has got up, he'd be in bed and asleep, and would get up and go down and cut beefsteak, and we'd have a steak fry after we got home. Or maybe we'd bake pancakes and have some sausage. And there always was lots to eat. Maybe it wasn't fancy food, but we had lots of good food, and we really had the appetites, because we would get out and do our exercise without having artificial means to do it. We'd roll in the snow and rode horseback in the summer, and that was another pastime that we had when we had some leisure hours, was to take the horses and ride around. We never seemed to be bored, because we didn't have anything in particular to do.
Do you remember any of the buildings that they were going up, what precipitated their being built and so on?
Well, I remember how Dad got started. When Dad and Mother were married, Dad was working for Grandpa at $20 a month. And they lived in a tenant house that Grandpa had, that stands where the present home out at the farm is, where Alice and Walt live. And they, Dad, who was full of ambition too, he could look ahead. He saw this farm, or this land that was for sale, that was right adjoining Grandpa's farm, and it was covered with timber, and he wanted to buy it. He wanted to buy this land and go on his own. And Grandpa, who never minced words, he said, no man can serve two masters. If you want that land and go on your own, you're on your own. Then I'll get someone else to work for me. So Dad said, okay. And Grandpa says, you'll have to let me have the house, because I get someone to work for me. I'll have to have the house. And Dad said, give me 2 weeks and I'll be out. And he went out and cut the timber and built the present foundation, or frame of the house, of the present house, out of hewn timbers and green lumber. And he promised my mother at the time that that would be eventually a granary, but they would live in it for a few years until he could build a better house. But they never got any further, but they just kept adding on to that one. But it proved to be a pretty well-built place, because it stood up in the tornado when a lot of the other buildings went with the wind. But it was across the road from where it stands now, and when I was about 11 or 12 years old, we moved the house across the highway and added on to it, and to the present form that it is now. I remember so well, one night we slept with the house standing right in the middle of the road, which would be a bad thing to do today with all the traffic that's going by, but in those days the traffic could detour because it was just horses and wagons. But so many times I think about it when I look at the house. The ceilings were 7-foot ceilings, which is quite low and all, and as we grew up, some of us had to almost stoop to get through the doorways, but I guess it wasn't so bad. We were a pretty healthy lot. We stood up under all the conditions.
How about any of the barns? Were there when they built the horse
barn? Yeah. We had three big buildings on top of the hill eventually. The first barn was built right after the house was built, because I can't remember when the one barn wasn't there, but I do remember when they built what they called the slaughterhouse, and because Dad used to do string butchering, and he had this place built. He had a blacksmith shop, a slaughterhouse, and a big corn crib, and then down below was a big pig pen. And when we were youngsters, we used to go upstairs, and a greenery upstairs in it. And we used to go upstairs there in the greenery, and where we could look down in the slaughterhouse and watch them butcher all these different animals, which was quite a thing. I don't know whether I'd be able to stand there and take it today, but I used to have a lot more nerve than I have now. But there was always something going on. And then in 1912, I think it was, they built the big horse barn. We always had a lot of horses, lots of teams. And they built this barn, which was about 80 feet long and 40 feet wide. And it had room for about 40 horses in there. And upstairs in the barn was the hayloft, which had a finished floor in it. And the summer that they built the barn, before they got it filled with hay, we used to have dances up there, and we did have fun. I'm telling you, that really was fun. We had some real dances up in that barn. But that and the big old barn that had stood there for over 60 years and the slaughterhouse were completely demolished in the tornado, which was quite a thing. I've always thought that I was awfully glad that Dad and Mother weren't here to see that complete destruction of what they had worked so hard to build up. But the farm is still going on. They've partially rebuilt and modernized some of the barn especially is now built to take care of this herd of milking cattle that they have there, and it's still producing. It has proven to be one of the best farms in the whole county as far as producing is concerned, and it still is right up there with the rest of them. Dad was always interested in lumbering, and as Mother used to say, when it come fall and the potatoes were in and everything was harvested, Dad would get what you call the timber itch. He couldn't stand it until he got someplace where he could start cutting trees for the winter. And he had many different lumbering operations in it that I recall. Some of them he made real good on. I remember so well, he had a camp over at what they call Fouch, over at the end of Lake Leelanau. And that spring when he come out, and that was back in around 1904 or 1905, when they come out of the camp, he had his farm all paid for. And all his bills were taken care of, and he had $7,000 in the bank, which was considered quite a fortune in those days. And he just seemed to have a magic touch at that time. Anything that he would undertake, he could make money at. And he went on at different places that he had camps, and then I think it was about 1907, he went over and bought High Island, which is the small beaver, and set up a lumbering operation over there. It was a big deal, and it really had some of the most beautiful timber that anybody could ever hope to see there. It was all virgin timber when he got there. He had a big mill there set up, and it was a real modern, up-to-date sawmill. And they lumbered there for several years. That was pretty rugged. At times, the big lake froze over, and they had to cross on the ice. And there was times that they went over with small tugboats and were lost out in the lake there. They'd break down and floating around out there. The big car ferry would take overloads of stuff. I went over one Thanksgiving for with Mother and some of the rest of the gang to spend Thanksgiving over there, and we went on the car ferry, and at that time they didn't have the dock, but the water was so deep that the car ferry could back up within about 20 feet of the shore, and we had to get off onto a barge, and which they pushed into the shore, and there was where I had my first baked trout, which is to me the only way to really cook trout. Mother had taken a can of cream over with her because they didn't have the cows on the island like we had on the farm. And we had a cook who was an old-time camp cook that got our Thanksgiving dinner for us that day. And he had a huge lake trout that he split down the center and poured this cream and salt and pepper on it and put it in the oven and baked it. And I never ate anything in my life that tasted like that did. And if ever I think of trout, I think of baking it in that way. But Dad was on the island until about 1911. And he practically lost his shirt there. The money situation got bad through the country, and bottom fell out of the market, and he really was practically cleaned on that job. But he didn't let it get him down. It wasn't many years afterwards until he was in other big lumbering operations, and some of them he made real good on, some of them he didn't do so good. But towards the later years, he seemed to have lost his magic touch and took some pretty bad bumps, and I've heard him say so many, many times that he came into this world with nothing, and that was the way he was going to depart, and he practically did that very thing. But it wasn't lack of ambition or trying, it's just that he overextended at times and got too optimistic about what he could do, and times don't always work out the way you anticipate.
You tell about growing potatoes and strawberries and that, and the time when you took the load of potatoes in.
We had this big farm, and it was a big farm. It was 320 acres of about the best land that you could find, and it was a big operation. Dad, in the early years, raised potatoes. One year he had as high as 70 acres of potatoes. And in those days, they were all planted, cultivated, and harvested by hand. There was no potato planters or potato diggers or what have you. It was all done by hand. And we used to have as high as 25 men working in the potato fields in the fall when it would come harvest time, and would get those potatoes out. When I think of it today, I just can't imagine that they could do that much work with the kind of tools that they had to work with. But he was really what you'd call a potato king in his day, and some years made very well on them. Other years, of course, you couldn't hardly give them away, but it was still a good cash crop to have in the fall. And I remember so well in the years before we got into the First World War, potatoes were, they begin to go up, the price of potatoes. And of course, I always helped pick up potatoes. I think I picked up enough potatoes to, well, I don't think that I'd want to do it over again, but it was fun. I used to enjoy it, and I got well paid for it, too. And I remember so well this year that the potatoes began to go up in price. By that time, we had a car, and I had gone into Traverse in the morning to get something for the place there, and on the way home I met so many loads of potatoes going into Traverse, and I made the remark at the lunch table that day, or dinner table, that I had even met a woman riding on driving a load of potatoes. And Dad, who always thought he'd cut us down to size because we girls had gone into Traverse to high school, and he thought we were just getting a little bit too snooty for our own good. He said, well, now that was something, wasn't it? He said, to see a woman driving a load of potatoes. He said, now that was really a disgrace. And I said, well, at the price of potatoes they are today, I don't know but what I would do the same thing if I had the money from the potatoes. So he said, I'll just bet you the biggest load of potatoes that we can load on the place and the best team to haul them that you want drive that team into Traverse with that load of potatoes. And I said, when do we start? And he said, tomorrow morning we'll have it loaded. We'll be ready. And I said, okay. And my younger sister, Maud, said, well, where did I come in on this? And Dad always called her Little Missy. And he says, well, for you, Little Missy, we'll give the second biggest load and the second best team, and you can have it if you will drive it in. She said, well, have it ready. We'll go tomorrow morning. So we left before daylight the next morning. It was frosty and cold and all, and drove the teams into Traverse on these loads, and we had to drive them onto the Hanley Dock. It was where they were unloading them. And Dad took the car. He was up there when we got there and didn't ask us to drive them out on the dock because the horses were a little bit afraid of the water and all. But we unloaded the load, and I don't just recall, but I think I got around $130 for my load, and Maud had $115 for her load, which was the easiest money I ever made in my life. And I had more fun spending it. It was just, it really was something. I know the papers were there. They notified the papers, and they took pictures of us and had our pictures in the paper and all that sort of stuff. But it didn't hurt us a bit. We just had a lot of fun over it. We used to go into Traverse to high school, and for 4 years, I drove back and forth from the farm, which was about 9.5 miles, with a horse and buggy, or horse and cutter, except for 2 months in one, it was my sophomore year, there was 2 months during the winter that it was so cold and we had so much snow that we were freezing our faces in the morning before we'd get there. We'd have our noses frosted, and they let us stay in for these 2 months that we roomed in Traverse. But the rest of the time, I drove back and forth. I used to start out before daylight in the morning and get back after dark at night. Through rain or snow or sleet, we always kept on going. Mary Heinforth Roofley, and I drove back and forth the first few years, and then my sister Maud went the last 2 years that I was there. She went to high school, so she and I went together. And then there were several from that corner that used to go, and sometimes we would team up and all go in one sleigh, or, well, usually in the sleigh. We didn't go together in the buggies. We used to have our separate ways. And we'd drive the horse into the livery barn in Traverse, and they would take it and put it up for the day, and then we'd walk up to school and come back at night, and they'd hitch up the horse for us, and we'd drive home. But there wasn't a heated school bus that pulled up to the door. We many a time I've been spilled out with the horse and cutter, and one time especially I remember my dad was riding with me. And we had an old horse that we called Barney, who was a wonderful friend of the family, I guess you'd have to call him. He had more sense, more genuine horse sense than a lot of people I know. But if we'd tip over when Barney, we were driving Barney, he'd stop and he'd stand just as quiet as could be until we got things straightened up and to go again, where some of them would take off if they heard a commotion behind them, but this time we tipped over, and Dad was on the downhill side. I landed right on top of him, and we had these big fur coats, and were bundled up so, and all the robes and things, and you could hardly move, and I just sat there and laughed. Dad was just ready to murder me, I guess, but we finally got straightened up and got home. But I've had a lot of trips, and one night we came home with, we had Mary's horse that time, and we had this heavy wet snow, and the horse had blinders on its bridle, and we couldn't understand what was the matter with it. It kept stumbling around so funny, and usually if it was storming, we'd just hook the lines over the dashboard and let the horse take you home, because they'd find their way. They seemed to just know how to go by themselves. But this horse kept falling off the road and stumbling around, and we couldn't figure out what was the trouble. When we got home and looked at him, the snow had packed in completely around these blinders, and it was just, his eyes were frozen shut. He couldn't see, the poor thing. He was just walking blind, but he took us home anyhow.
How about the time you got
to hold on to the reins? My dad always taught us that never to let go of the lines. When you're driving the horses, never to let go of the lines. And he had a lot of colts, an awful lot of colts we had on the farm there, and he would break them. And maybe he'd hitch them up for a couple of days, and then he'd hitch them on one of the older, quieter horses, more reliable ones, and we would start driving them. I've driven colts into Traverse that had only been hitched up two or three times, many a time. And he always preached, don't let go of the lines. No matter what happens, hang on to those lines. Well, I had gone in with the milk. We used to sell milk to the dairy in Traverse, and I'd taken that in, and the road would have these, what they call sloughs on them. They'd build up high in the center, and we didn't have the snow plows then. And then they'd slide off to one side or the other, and it was real bad, and the asylum in Traverse, the state hospital, was hauling ice out of Cedar Lake, and they were going with several teams there, and I met one of these when on the way home, and they slewed over and caught the cutter, and I had a team of colts at the time that I was driving, and of course, that frightened them, and they jumped, and it broke the tongue loose from the cutter, and they, of course, took off, and I hung on the lines. They took me right over the dashboard and down the road, around my belly. I had a big fur coat on and a stocking cap, and was all bundled up, and they went for, it was better than a half mile before I got them stopped, and when I brought them back, the man that had hit me was standing there waiting for me to come back, and he just looked at me and he says, "My God, I didn't know that was a girl on the end of that line." I brought him back, and they hitched him up again and brought him home. Another time I was down on the lake shore with a little driving horse that we had that was real skittish and nervous, but she was a lovely little horse to drive. And something happened with the buggy that the front wheels are let loose. The front end of the buggy let down, and she took off for home as hard as she could go. And luckily, there was a big hill there that she had to go up. And I hung on, but then that time, it was summertime, and I didn't have too many clothes on, and she dragged me on the gravel till I was skinned raw along the side, but I stopped her before she got away from me, too. But that holds on even today with driving the car. I think about that so many, many times, of his saying, "Don't ever let go of the lines. Hang on to those lines, and you'll come up a lot better and won't ruin the horses." to give you the history of how Dad and I met. The very first time that we recall of ever seeing each other was in the old school at Sutton's Bay, where a Friday afternoon they used to have contests or just something a little different than they had regularly. And I remember being there one time when they had art, and they had two of the girls with the same kind of hats and dresses on stood up in front of the class, and you were supposed to draw them. Well, I didn't know too from it about drawing, and I felt so bad because I didn't like the idea to think that I couldn't do what everybody else did. But one time, I used to go to Sutton's Bay to visit my cousin, Mary Peck Marsh, and stay there. Our school would be out much earlier than their school was, and I would stay there, and then I'd go into school with her. And we had this arithmetic contest one Friday afternoon. And, well, I don't remember. I'm about the third grade. And they would put these problems on the board, and then you had to go up and work out these long division problems. And I went up and worked out mine, and the party that stood beside me was having difficulties, and he said that now he had been sick and been out of school, and he didn't know what it was all about. But I don't know whether he had the temptation to crown me or what, but I didn't know at the time that it would be the person that I would eventually marry. But I do recall the occasion of when we were working these long division problems. Then it went on for many years. I used to hear about the Grances, that through the Peck family, they told about that they had sold out and moved out to Montana and or Idaho, and then I heard that they'd come back, and he would start up in the shoe business again, but it didn't mean too much to me. But when we were older, the cousins, the group of we girls, there were eight of us all together, used to go down to Grandma Peck's place after our summer's work was done, usually along the middle of last of August. We would go down there for a 2 weeks camping trip. And it was more or less what you'd call camping, because Grandma wasn't staying there. And that is only just when she'd go down, when we would be there, or some of the other aunts would, our relatives would go with us. And we'd take our bedding and everything, and we just had a grand time there. And this time, we were standing out by the highway, and there was some sort of a doings over on Larson's Point. And down the road come this two men. It was Griswold and Con. And Griswold knew we girls. He'd been over at Hatches Crossing years before. And so he stopped to talk to us and introduced us to this blonde Norwegian, and I thought he looked like a pretty nice sort of a person, but he didn't pay any attention to me, and I had a girlfriend there with me, and next thing I knew, he was dating my girlfriend, and I was kind of left out. But it went on for a few weeks, and we met up again. We were at the Teachers Institute at Leland. He was teaching, and I was thinking some of going into the teaching, and I guess that's how I happened to be over there. I don't just recall how I happened to go over there, and we met up again, and we spent some time walking around and visiting, and from then on, we would get together quite often. And then the next year, when we went down camping, Mary Ruefli and I, of course, have always been pals, and we were there, and Con came over and he said that his friend Adolf wanted to meet up with one of the girls, and he was going to drive into Traverse and take Ben Whitmore in, and he thought that if we get a girl for him, why, the four of us would take Glenn in. So I introduced Adolf to Mary, and so the four of us went, and from that time on, we have been practically inseparable. Wasn't very long until Mary and Adolf decided they were going to get married, and then we decided that would be the thing to do. But then the war come along and sort of interrupted our plans, and it was 4 years from the time that we really